Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3125, United States of America versus Samuel H. Vinton, Jr., appellant. Ms. Dyer for appellant, Mr. Perez for appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Samuel Vinton, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Police officers stopped and eventually arrested Mr. Vinton and searched a locked briefcase in his car. The district court found that the officers had probable cause of CDW, or carrying a dangerous weapon, a District of Columbia offense, based on two knives that they found in the car. That offense requires probable cause that Vinton intended, or his purpose in carrying those knives, was to use them as weapons. But the district court...
There's a way in which the government's position could be upheld without even considering the CDW offense, and that's the Ross analysis.
We don't believe that there was probable cause. The government does not provide very much analysis for why
possession. It's a very
possession...
part of the brief, to be sure, but I would take the basic proposition is that the presence at that point of, depending how you count, two or four weapons, one of them concealed and one of them a type that certainly does not seem as if it's... certainly doesn't fit the phishing model, that by that time there's already been a lie, a search for further weapons, potentially illegal, is basically their case under Ross.
First, the butterfly knife, the district court did not find that it was inherently a weapon, and the government does not argue that.
I'm not saying that. I'm putting that issue aside.
It is potentially a fishing knife. It is comparable to a utility knife, and this court cannot make findings based on this record that it's anything more than a utility knife, or at least based on what...
Well, you may call it what you will. It's a knife hidden under the... under a mat in the front seat, right?
Second, the normal state of people's possessions in their car is to be not in plain view. When you leave your car, when most people leave their car locked
in
the city...
But under the mat, the front seat seems to me somewhat special.
A lot of people leave their keys under the mat in the front seat. He may have put it there in order so that nobody would see it and come into the car and steal it, or in order to simply hide it. As most people put things in the console, a lot of times people's consoles are full, or the knife happens to be at somebody's feet, and it's tucked under the floor mat in order to conceal it from people outside of the car.
In most of these cases, there are always alternative explanations.
But there was no reason...
We're talking just about elements that put together with other elements may make a case.
None
for
of those,
probable cause to believe that there are illegal weapons there.
Neither of those knives were necessarily viewed as weapons. They were not inherently viewed as weapons by the court or the government, the district court.
I don't think it makes any difference what they're called by the officers or by the district court.
It does make a difference as to whether you conclude that Mr. Vinton lied or that he even misled the officer in stating that there were no weapons in the car. There's no reason he would presume that they were weapons if he used these knives for fishing or for picnics or for other such purposes. There's also no reason that the government provides why he would possess anything other...
He didn't use the mace for picnics.
Well, the mace, the officer did not think was particularly unusual given his...
I don't care what the officer thought.
Given his stated profession as a bodyguard. But bodyguards don't typically carry knives to use in their profession. They might carry mace, which is legal to carry in the District of Columbia.
We're talking about a point during the episode after which Vinton had said he had no weapons, right?
But why would
mace may be a defensive weapon, but it is a weapon, is it not?
I don't view it as a weapon. It's a self-defense kind of tool. The officers did not suggest, and the district court did not suggest. As a matter of fact, the district court did not apparently consider the mace at all in its conclusions.
I thought your brief was generally very good, but you kept going back to what was actually in the mind of the officer, but that's irrelevant under the law.
I understand that that's irrelevant. I think that the circumstances in this case demonstrate that there was no suspicion of Mr. Vinton, in particular with respect to the search of the briefcase under Ross, or under a probable cause standard. I don't see, and the government has not provided any reason why, when he kept two knives loose in the car, he would possess anything else in a locked briefcase that was similar to those knives. There's no reason that he would possess other types of weapons, such as guns, based on two weapons that are not inherently, knives that are not inherently weapons, excuse me. There's no reason to suggest that he would possess more of those types of weapons, but even if there was, there's no reason to suggest that those two knives indicated any more serious type of knife. It may have indicated...
All you need, let's assume there's probable cause to arrest and we're into the Gantt reason to believe standard. All you need is reason to believe that there's going to be evidence relevant to the offense of arrest.
That's correct.
And reason to believe is not a high standard, and relevant obviously gives you some room as well as an officer.
But that offense is carrying a dangerous weapon, and the only element that the officers arguably didn't have was whether his purpose in carrying
the knives...
Exactly,
and wouldn't it be relevant to that offense and relevant to showing purpose if there were additional weapons?
Not if there were additional similar types of knives. Why would they show his purpose when those two knives don't inherently show his purpose? Mm-hmm. Unless he's acting in some way, carrying them into a public building, threatening someone, acting in some way that shows otherwise that he's dangerous. Other utility knives or similar types of knives, another sheathed knife, even if two knives would indicate that he might carry more of those types of knives, and I don't think there's anything to suggest that he would carry anything more serious. Even if there were multiple knives, how does that show his intent? He may have multiple knives for fishing. He may also hunt. Mm-hmm. He may take picnics or have other reasons that
That's all going to come in when you're trying to figure out whether this is beyond a reasonable doubt, of course. But at this point, the officers are just thinking, reason to believe, again, assuming there's probable cause for the arrest, reason to believe evidence relevant. And it strikes me in a case where you're dealing with weapons or drugs that looking in the containers of the car for additional weapons or drugs is at least relevant.
Even if there were probable cause that his intent in carrying those two utility knives was to use them as a weapon, there's nothing to suggest that he would carry something more serious in a locked briefcase when he has those loose in a car. It doesn't indicate that he would then lock something else. Why would he lock it up when he has the rest of them loose? Second,
why did he? That's a bootstrap, and I'm not using that as a justification. But you're saying it's implausible that they could be in the briefcase, and of course there were things.
Well, the officer had a hunch that turned out to be correct, but that does not mean that the officer had a right to invade his privacy by opening a locked briefcase in the car. And I don't, this court has said weapons suggest other weapons, but that's in the context of a dagger, which is inherently a weapon, and guns, which are inherently weapons, multiple guns.
From the perspective of the police officer, do you think a police officer should be required to make the kind of judgment between a dagger and a different kind of knife as to whether that provides reason to believe
further
weapons? I mean, that just seems to put an impossible burden on the officers rather than the clear rules.
Do that, and this is an example of that, where the officer didn't view the sheath knife, which he said he used for fishing, and I'm not suggesting that this court should use that to find no probable cause or no reason to believe, but I think it is an indication that not all knives, a Swiss Army knife, for example, which the butterfly knife has been compared to, would not necessarily be a weapon. A sheath knife is not necessarily a weapon. Therefore, the reason to believe standard that there would inherently be other weapons or more serious weapons in a locked briefcase, it doesn't necessarily follow. I think it's reflexive to say weapons suggest other weapons. In the case of drugs, it's quite different because people who use drugs often have a stash in their car or in their house. People who sell drugs frequently keep different collections of drugs in different places, so they wouldn't necessarily have them all in their person.
So can I ask you one question about the other way the government tries to get this in under Gantt, which is that it was reasonable for the officers to rely on the case law at the time, and therefore they didn't need the reason to believe. They just had the automatic right under Belton to search the car incident to arrest. Can you respond to that? And
yes, I have.
In particular, the Kroll case. It's very difficult to distinguish this from Kroll on that.
I can distinguish this from Kroll, but I'd like to make a couple of other points about the exclusionary rule, if I can, first, that were not made in our brief. First, people talk about the cost of that rule. The real cost is the Fourth Amendment itself, where hundreds or thousands of criminals go free every day because officers decline to invade their privacy. So the compliance with the Fourth Amendment itself is where the really, really big cost comes in. So I'd like to point that out. Second, the retroactivity doctrines should govern because the exclusionary rule is a rule, and there was no recognized exception to that rule at this time in Gantt. And therefore, the judicially created remedy in Gantt is applicable here. Third, with respect to Kroll, both Leon and Kroll involved a second branch of government approving the officer's search. Leon involved the magistrate judge on the specific facts that the officer intended to act on, so the specific case at issue. Kroll involved the legislature's prospective attempt to provide contours to a police officer's authority. So the legislature is acting prospectively to govern the officer's actions in the cases, in all the collection of cases that the officers intend to act on. Gantt, in contrast, and any court decision in contrast, is looking backwards at specific facts of the case before it. It is not intended to apply prospectively. That's why the legislature provides kind of a check on the officers.
But Herring says, of course, that the whole purpose of the exclusionary rule is to prevent officers from deliberately violating the Constitution, acting with knowledge that they're violating the Constitution. And when you're relying on Belton, which was the law at the time, it's hard to square that with the language in Herring, I think.
Well, Herring is also different because it involved a clerical error. And I think that a clerical error...
Yeah, I'm talking more about the language in Herring, which is broad, and how to interpret that is going to be the subject of future cases, obviously.
And the fact that the court focused on deterrence in Herring does not mean that the whole purpose of judicial integrity in the exclusionary rule is absent. But I think deterrence also should apply here. Thornton presaged a possible change to Belton. And this court had ruled that assess what the area of search is permitted as of the time of the arrest and not as of the time of the search. So that in several cases, this court ruled that, and the government cites Wellesley and Tavolacci. But there are many cases in which this court holds that. So that if the defendant is arrested, taken somewhere else, and the search is essentially not too distant in time after that, that it would take place in the Schmell area would be the area as of the time of the arrest. But that the Supreme Court had never upheld that before, and I think that was not obvious once Thornton was decided that Belton would continue to be interpreted the way that it was. We want to provide incentives for everybody in the system, this court, the lower courts, and police officers, and the people who train police officers to get it right. So we don't want to, what I'd like to point out is that it is police officers' duty, and we do want them to push the limits of the Fourth Amendment. We want them to ferret out crime within the contours that are provided for them, and that are basically the contours of the original framers who decided that we were going to let some crimes go undetected because police officers could not invade homes and cars and personal possessions. So it's the court's duty to provide limits on officers within the Fourth Amendment's context and within the framers' intent. But it is officers' duty to push officers, plural, to push the limits of that of where they can go. They are going to go as far as courts will let them go. But we want to provide incentives and to deter them from pushing those limits too far while courts assess and evaluate where those contours are of their authority.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, James Perez on behalf of the United States. Unless this court has any questions with respect to the Terry frisk of appellant's vehicle, I would like to begin by addressing the actual search of the locked briefcase.
Well, let's just review what you have on the Terry frisk of the vehicle. You have the sheathed knife in plain view. You have the tinted windows.
Correct. We also, in our brief, we also referred to the fact that defendant admitted that he, in his line of work, carried weapons. In response to the officer's question, do you have any other weapons in the car? Defendant stated, no, I keep that stuff at home.
Well,
I keep that part of my trade at home.
I mean, what that seems to mean is that security, people involved in the security field are, that counts against them in circumstances like this?
Not at all, Your
Honor. No?
Not at all, Your Honor. I think that what it goes to is the reasonable and articulable suspicion that an officer can feel at that particular time. If you look at the atmospherics of the situations as well, it was 9 o'clock at nighttime. Officer Alton was alone.
Let's just stick with the fact that he is in the security field.
Sure.
I'm really puzzled at that counting against him.
Well, it's not so much that he's in the security field, it's that he has access to weapons, and that because he has access.
The second follows automatically, right?
Correct. But not only that, we also see in the back seat within reaching distance an actual weapon, a 10-inch knife, the blade of which is 45.
Not one that, at least I naively perhaps, don't associate with the security field.
Correct. So if we had a driver who admitted that he was in the security field, but you did not see a weapon on the back seat within reaching distance, that might be a different story, but we don't have that here. Here we have a 10-inch knife on the back seat, certainly within reaching distance of appellant. And the district court made that finding, and that was a clear finding. That's a finding that appellant does not dispute on appeal. So whether or not somebody's in a security field, I don't think is a per se reason to search their vehicle. But we have more than that here.
But being in the security field with a knife not associated with the security enterprise.
Correct.
So that his answer on that is completely consistent with the facts, right?
Well, I don't think that Long requires or Terry requires an officer to necessarily believe his explanation that he was using it for.
I'm just trying to figure out what the officer actually had at the point where he embarks on the protective sweep. And I see the tinted windows. I see the presence of the knife.
Correct.
And you add in answers which indicate that he is in the field of security and therefore would have weapons. Yeah.
Correct.
It indicates that he would have weapons to be used in the security field, which I take it is generally thought to be on the side of law enforcement rather than against it.
I think that's right, Your Honor, Judge Williams, but we have a weapon on it. I don't think we can forget that to put into put
I'm
the situation
in. I'm just trying to figure out how much more you have.
Sure, I just don't want to put the situation out of the context of what the officer was actually seeing at the time when he heard that defendant was in security fear and had access to weapons when he stated, oh, I keep that stuff at home or I keep that part of my trade at home. If we did not have the weapon on the back seat, it may be a harder case, but we have the weapon.
How about if you only had the weapon on the back seat?
Well, I think that
you had nothing else, just the weapon on the back seat. It seems to me a reasonable officer probably would think that's something to be careful about and therefore would justify potentially a Terry frisk of the car to make sure there are no other weapons that the driver could access.
Yeah, I think that's right, Judge Kavanaugh, because in Christian, we had the dagger, which was in a locked car, but it was plainly visible through the window. In Long itself, there was a hunting knife on the floorboard. So there was other situations, but what I think the Supreme Court focused on was that there was a visible hunting knife within the passenger's compartment of the vehicle. So what
Excuse me. But here, you actually have a car that stopped because of tinted windows. That's what the officer says catches his attention. That's why he stops him.
As well as speeding, too.
Well, and perhaps speeding. But it's a traffic infraction, essentially. That's the crime for which he stopped. That's the only suspicion that the policeman has at that time. Then he sees the knife, which he removes from the car.
Correct.
Goes back to his vehicle, checks the tint on the windows, finds that there's a violation, and so he's going to just write him a ticket for the window violation. Why shouldn't the detention have ended there?
Well, it could have very well, and the officer admitted that had the other officer, the MPD officer, Officer Hulk, had not driven by, that he probably would not have put defendant out of the car.
Isn't that just fortuity then? That's not that he has a suspicion about anything. It's just that now he happens fortuitously to have backup, and so he goes further.
Well, the standard is objectively reasonable. Whether or not this officer was taking a risk by not pulling a defendant out of the car before another MPD officer came is his subjective viewpoint at the time. It's objectively reasonable. And I would just point out, too, the record is clear that the reason he asked Officer Hulk to stop was he said, you know, I do have this knife, and, you know, I would like to pull a defendant out of the car. Whether or not it's just by faith, I think it's pretty irrelevant to the analysis because the standard is objectively reasonable.
Isn't it odd that he put the knife on the top of the car? That was a very unusual way to protect himself.
Yeah, and again, that's why I say it's objectively reasonable. Yeah. And whether or not this officer, you know, this officer was a 3-year veteran at the time. I think relatively he was pretty inexperienced. But again, that's why the standard is objectively reasonable. I would just, as far as the Terry Frisco, I would just point this court to Long and Christian itself because both of those cases involve knives in the passenger compartment of the vehicle. Moving on to, unless this court has any other questions regarding the Terry Frisco, moving on to the search of the actual locked briefcase. Officers had probable cause to arrest appellant for carrying a dangerous weapon because not only do we have the 10-inch knife within reaching distance of appellant and appellant questionable explanation about fishing, but there's no other visible fishing gear within a passenger compartment. We also, following the Terry Frisco, we also have another knife that's found concealed under passenger side floorboard.
What about, might be your next issue, but what about Ms. Dyer's point that there's not reason to believe there might be further knives in a briefcase just because there are two knives elsewhere in the car? This is really going to the Gantt reason to believe issue.
Yeah, sure, Your Honor. I think that a couple issues. One, we have the knife, the 10-inch knife on the back seats that's seated next to the briefcase. That's number one. Number two, the butterfly knife that Officer Alton described as one that he's seen in martial art films, and Kung Fu films, I believe it was, that's concealed as well, which suggests that defendant, appellant, has the propensity to conceal his weapons. And because he's concealing that weapon, as well as the two cans of mace within the armrest, it suggests that the briefcase itself may also conceal weapons. But irrespective of that particular issue, we also have the standing issue, which defendant admitted several times that he did not own the briefcase. Under this court's case law, it's very clear a disclaimer of ownership of a particular bag or item that was searched is sufficient in and of itself to constitute abandonment. It doesn't require, contrary to what appellant brief states, it does not require a physical abandonment of the actual item. And I'll point it to a couple cases, the Dennis Lewis case, as well as the Denny case from the Tenth Circuit that stands for those propositions. Finally, Your Honors, aside from the Gantt issue, aside from the reason to believe that the actual briefcase had weapons in it, and aside from the standing issue, we also, in our brief, rely on the probable cause under Ross. And in this case, this court case, Rocky Brown, the court said because there was a weapon, in that case it was a gun, inside the car, that in and of itself also, actually in those circumstances, it also gave probable cause to believe that the trunk also carried other contrabands and weapons, not necessarily bullets, but any other weapons. So we rely on that case as well to establish a Ross probable cause to believe that the briefcase in and of itself contained additional weapons. Unless this court has any other questions.
Yep. You argue that there was no arrest at the point where Vinton is put into handcuffs.
Correct.
Do you have any authority for such a proposition?
Well, he specifically, Alton, the officer, specifically told appellant that he was not under arrest.
No.
Yeah, we do cite.
Would a reasonable person think that he was not under arrest when he was put in handcuffs, notwithstanding that he was told he's not under arrest?
We do cite to a few cases in which, not from this circuit, I believe it was from the Second Circuit as well as the Ninth Circuit, in which handcuffs in and of themselves are not indicative of an arrest. Here, not only do we have handcuffs, but the officer explicitly told appellant, look, I'm putting you in handcuffs for my safety. You're not under arrest. It's only for my safety. So I think in view of that, no reasonable person can say, oh, I'm under arrest. It's just for safety purposes as I search this vehicle.
Would a reasonable person think he was free to move on? As I believe is the way the test is formulated.
I,
and the officer had his license, I guess both his driver's license and his car.
Correct. License. I think that's
free to move on foot, handcuffed.
Right. No, I don't think that's, from my understanding, Judge Williams, I respectfully don't think that's the test. I think the test is whether or not a reasonable person would feel like they're under arrest. Free to move on is the Terry stop issue, whether or not an individual who, whether or not there's a consensual encounter. And the test under a consensual encounter is whether or not a person feels like they're free to move on. Of course, we have a valid Terry stop here. Whether or not a person feels like they're under arrest is viewed from an objectively reasonable person in that circumstances. And I don't think free to move on is part of that test. So I would respectfully disagree with that. Unless this court has any other questions, we will ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
May I have a minute?
Ms. Dyer, you were out of time, but we'll give you a minute.
Thank you very much, Judge Brown. I just had a couple of points with respect to the government's argument. With respect to the facts showing probable cause, the government tries to argue that one knife was in plain view and the other knife was concealed, and therefore somehow that altogether suggests in a locked briefcase, and I don't quite understand how those two things add up. With respect to whether Mr. Vinton was armed and dangerous, supporting the Terry frisk, on page 39 of the transcript, the officer testifies that before Officer Hoke arrived, I had no intent to search further. So,
but that's the same.
Anything. I mean, his mind could have been completely wool gathering at the time. It wouldn't affect the legal issue.
I don't think that just the fact of a knife in every single case supports
a frisk.
I understand
that proposition.
All right. So we are somewhere between somewhat less suspicious than Long, where the defendant was possibly drunk or inebriated or under the influence of something and was non-responsive. And in Christian, where it was a dagger and it was much more inherently a weapon. With respect to whether the officers unreasonably extended the stop, I'd just like to point out that there's nothing in the record that happened between finding the butterfly knife and when Officer Alton called for Investigator Hodge to come. So there was no sort of escalation between those two events.
In the period when Vinton was handcuffed, did he say anything of any consequence that was brought out at trial?
He talked about the girlfriend and his girlfriend and his boyfriend might have had borrowed the car. So that's one thing that was brought out. I think the other thing that was brought out was that he used the earplugs for sleeping aids, which they concluded was suspicious, but which the district court did not and the government does not rely on. If there are no other questions, I thank you very much.